All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. It's Anti-War Radio. I'm Scott Horton, and our first guest today is the great Pepe Escobar from the Asia Times Online, author of Obama Does Globalist Stand, and regular guest on all kinds of things. You can find him, of course, at atimes.com. Here he is at tomdispatch.com, and then, of course, under Tom's name at antiwar.com, sinking the petrodollar in the Persian Gulf. Welcome back, Pepe. How are you doing?
Wonderful. Great to be with you again, Scott.
Well, you know, I know it's 1920s technology or something, but I'm still fascinated. I can talk to you, and you're on the phone in Thailand right now. It's pretty far away to me, but I guess if you travel all around the world all the time, it's not that far, huh?
Well, this is my hood, actually. I lived here on and off for, I don't know, 15 years or so. So, oh, like, being home.
Right. Well, I'm way over here in Texas, and it sure seems far away.
Well, I miss Texas. I haven't been to Texas in a few years, so I really do miss it.
Sound traveling at the speed of light here. It's amazing. All right. So let's talk about what the hell is going on in the world, specifically all the brinksmanship in the Persian Gulf and all the hype and all the oil. This article at Tom Dispatch is really great. I love the way it begins with Tom's little summary of, oh, I don't know, post-World War II history of American intervention in Iran, and no, then and just to set up the background so that people know what's going on as you keep us up to date about how far, whose red line counts for what over there right now there.
And Tom told the whole story in 4 or 5 paragraphs.
Yeah, he does it very well, doesn't he?
Very, very well. Better than anything you read in the New York Times or the Washington Post for the past 30 years, you know.
Absolutely. I guess let's start with where you start this article. A very important thing. Last week, Leon Panetta basically retreated his red line for when we go to war all the way to when they actually have a nuclear bomb. Then we'll attack them, which doesn't seem like a good strategy to attack them at that point when they can actually really fight back. But anyway.
And by the way, after I finished the article, I think one day before publication, the red line changed again because of that letter that Obama sent to Supreme Leader Ayatollah Khamenei. And now the red line is, don't block the Strait of Hormuz, otherwise we're going to kick your ass.
Nobody ever thought that they were going to start a war by blocking the strait, right? That was always their warning of that they could fight back a little bit if we start bombing them. Everybody knows that.
Exactly. But the way the spinning in the Western corporate media, you know, in the U.S., in the major European countries, in Israel, is that now they are a threat because they are a threat to the global economy. This was just a reaction to the non-stop threats from the U.S. and Israel for the past, 2, 3, 4, 5 years, since 2005 at least. You know, it's on a weekly basis, and, you know, these past few months it's been on a daily basis. And this, we have to understand that this is also for internal consumption. They had to do something vis-a-vis the Iranian population, because, especially in Tehran and the big cities, they are very well informed. Most of them speak at least 2 or 3 other languages apart from Farsi. They follow everything that happens in the West. So they read about these threats, or their families in Paris, in London, or in L.A. telling about these threats every day. They say, what about our government? They don't do anything. So a few officials in the government, they said, look, maybe if we are attacked, we might consider blocking the Strait of Hormuz. Of course, they will never do it, because this is how they export their own oil as well.
But they're working on that, right? Building a pipeline over the other way, west across the Arabian Peninsula to Yemen.
You're totally right. Pipelines that go through Central Asia. They have, for instance, they have a swap agreement with Turkmenistan, so they have pipelines going from Iran to Central Asia. And from Central Asia, these pipelines go to China, for instance.
Or I was talking from
Turkmenistan-China
pipeline. I was talking about from northeastern Saudi Arabia to southwestern Saudi Arabia or Yemen at the Red Sea, right? Aren't they trying to bypass the Persian Gulf itself to the west?
Oh yes, this is another pipeline. This is the Emirates. They are building a pipeline from east to west as well, so they can bypass the the Strait of Hormuz. It's going to take a while. It's a very costly pipeline. It's going to take a while. It's $3 billion or something. So they are thinking about alternative strategies. But, of course, we have to look at the Sunni Shiite angle, which is also very important. Don't forget that the six GCC countries, the Gulf Cooperation Council, they are all Sunni monarchies. Obviously, they subscribe to that fiction that was invented by the House of Saud and King Abdullah of Jordan during the Bush administration about the Shiite crescent. So they think that it's Iran, Iraq, Syria, and Hezbollah against them, which is absolutely ridiculous because there's no expansionist policy inbuilt in the Islamic Republic of Iran. This is completely nuts. They just want to be respected as a regional power, and they are not. They're trampled upon by the U.S. and by the Europeans all the time. So let's go back 2 years ago. Remember when Brazil and Turkey organized that swap agreement? They flew their foreign ministers to Tehran. They sat down together for 18 hours. In the end, they had a swap agreement for uranium enrichment. The uranium would be transferred to Turkey and then back to Iran. And they clinched that deal. Why? Because they sat down, they talked, they respected the Iranians as a logical interlocutor, and in the end they had a deal. And the next day Hillary Clinton bombed the deal. We all remember the story, you know.
Yeah, so, and of course this was really their acceptance of what Obama had at least pretended to offer in the first place, which was at least implicitly recognize your enrichment of low-enriched uranium at 3.6% as long as you let any up to 20 or higher go over, you know, out of the country and let the French and the Russians do it for you.
And on top of it, Obama gave the guidelines to, at the time Lula was president of Brazil, Obama sent a letter to Lula outlining, look, when you sit down to negotiate with them, this is what we need. We means the West in general. And they got it. And they got it. This is completely crazy. The Brazilian foreign minister, he told us, I don't know, a little over a year ago, he said, look, when we flew to Tehran, we were thinking maybe we have a 1% chance of this thing working. And in the end, they manage because it's basic rules of diplomacy. And Iran, they have very able diplomats. You know, they are among the best in the world, very well educated. Even if they have, let's put it this way, an Islamist background, some of them, not all of them, they are career diplomats. They know how to play the game, and they are very able negotiators. But they are treated like shit by the Europeans and the Americans. And now with this letter, if you've been reading the Iranian press for the past 48 hours or so, there are some leaks about the letter. They say the first part of the letter is just threats. And the second part of the letter, Obama more or less says, look, you basically roll over and die. You accept everything that we're doing, the sanctions, more sanctions at the UN, our unilateral sanctions that I just approved 3 weeks ago, and then we'll sit down and talk. What kind of negotiation is this?
Well, and it's, they're kind of making fools out of themselves and out of the United States of America, it seems like to me, because like we started out in this thing, they keep backing their red line up. It used to be you cannot operate Natanz at all. And then it was, well, you can't turn on the Boucher reactor. And then it was, now it's, you can't make nukes, or you can't finish one, or you can't,
you cannot
go one day after finishing one or whatever. You know, they keep backing up at the same time that, as you say, they're putting on these would-be draconian sanctions. But as you detail in your article, they're not nearly so isolated as, say, for example, Iraq in the 1990s, where it was a UN Security Council resolution that had Russia and China on board for it and couldn't be repealed, basically, where Iraq was completely isolated. Iran still has more than half the world to trade with. America's really just, it's like Hillary Clinton throwing a temper tantrum in front of everyone. It's really all it amounts to, it seems like.
And even at that time, Scott, Iraq was selling, smuggling a lot of oil to Jordan in trucks. I saw that myself. You know, trucks in the middle of the night full of oil crossing the Iraqi-Jordanian border. So even if this thing worked, Iran could smuggle oil and gas to all of its neighbors, starting with Turkey, because they need it badly. Central Asia, obviously, because they have agreements. And with China, obviously, they can be paid anywhere in Hong Kong via a third bank in a fiscal paradise somewhere. And now, very interesting development as well. This, you know that soon there's going to be yuan trading at the City of London. London traders and people in Beijing, they are saying, look, this is practically a done deal. It's going to take a few months, but soon it's going to be a done deal. So now yuan is becoming an international currency de facto, even with the controls that are imposed by Beijing. This means, among other things, that soon Iran can sell its oil in yuan, not only to China, but to anybody that wants to pay in yuan as well. Mm. And even with this latest visit by Wen Jiabao, Prime Minister of China, he went to the GCC these past few days. He went to Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and the Emirates. He clinched a swap deal in the Emirates in yuan. So this means that the Emirates, who have these sovereign funds with almost $1 trillion reserves, you know, soon they're going to have yuan in their own reserves as well. And they're probably going to make a lot of money because yuan is going to appreciate further and further within the next few years, you know. And they, in terms of oil and gas, China and Iran are already trading in reals and yuan. China with Russia trades in reals and in rubles. With India pays for Iranian oil via a Turkish bank. So if you multiply this with other countries that do deals with Iran, they're going to be paying for the oil they need to Iran in a basket of currencies, in their own currencies, via third banks in fourth countries. And even American allies like Japan and South Korea, they already told the Obama administration, face-to-face, in fact, that they want exemptions from these because simply they cannot. South Korea imports 10% of their oil from Iran. They said, look, we need this, and there's nobody else to sell it to us, so that's it. You know, we want an exemption, and we'll get an exemption. And the Japanese, very politely, you know, in a very Japanese way, They told Tim Geithner, look, you put us in a very tough spot over here. I don't think we'll be able to follow your prescription this time, you know.
Well, and you know, the thing is about it, you know, it's a fungible resource. It's literally a liquid. So if they can still only sell it to China, that just means China buys less from somewhere else and whatever. But let me ask you this. What exactly is the nature of Iran's relationship with Venezuela? Because, of course, the war party would have it, you know, the Heritage Foundation report, I think it was. Oh, this is, you know, the Muslim takeover of South America to wage the jihad against us all, or something even worse than that, maybe, Pepe. What do you say?
Well, considering how misinformed these people are, you know, in one of the debates, Rick Santorum actually said that Hamas and Hezbollah were taking over Latin America. He actually said that. Can you believe it? Well, anyway, they have a lot of bilateral projects, investment on both sides. It's worth $4 to $5 billion. It's not a lot, you know, but it's the beginning. They are both OPEC members. So they coordinate what they do inside OPEC closely. And they want high oil prices for obvious reasons, for, you know, fighting unemployment. And in the case of Venezuela, still there's the inequality in Venezuela is still huge. And, you know, the Chavez ministries are not exactly well organized, as you probably know. And in Iran, because of the sanctions, of course, and because of mismanagement, Ahmadinejad, especially in the second term, he puts people in, planning ministries, minister of finance. These people don't know absolutely anything about economics. So it's a total disaster. No wonder the inflation rate is over 20%. And unemployment among young people is 25-30% in Iran. It's like, almost like Spain, you know. Mm-hmm. So they need high oil prices. In fact, everybody at the moment wants high oil prices. The Saudis, they need the oil at $100 a barrel because they, remember, a few months ago, they had this huge bribe program of most of their population. Okay, look, we'll give you a lot of money, state jobs and all that, but don't come up with this Arab Spring thing, you know, over here. So everybody wants high oil prices. But the motivations from different players are different, although everybody wants the same thing. So Iran, what they are trying to do is a very complicated thing. If they feel they have their backs against the wall all the time, they can always issue something like, look, we're going to try to close the Strait of Hormuz, and oil goes up $5-$10 in less than a week. So they have the ability, with saying three or four phrases, oil goes from 99, 101 to 115, 120. For the European
I really should have listened to him. Greg Palast said that years ago, that, man, nobody's going to have a war with Iran. This is all just about jacking up the oil price every time both sides are winking and elbowing each other.
Exactly. Look, and American big oil, you know, they're laughing all the way to the bank as well. So, you know, for big oil in the U.S., it's great to have oil at Brent at 114. It's fantastic, you know.
Yeah.
Over the past month.
I was reminded of, Greg, when I was reading your article, when you're talking about all these red lines and the kind of different ways of using that terminology. One of the things that Greg reported back then was that, going back decades, there had been a red line drawn around the Kirkuk oil reserves, I think mostly, and I guess some on the Iranian border, and the deal was to keep that oil off the market for the long term, to keep prices artificially high, and that was a policy between, I guess, Houston and London or whatever, that had gone back for decades.
Exactly. Look, and there's the Iraq angle as well. I got something this week. It's crazy. The Iraqis are saying that in a, what, 3 or 4 years, they're going to be producing 5 million barrels of oil a day. This is completely crazy. This means that in 3 or 4 or 5 years, oil could drop to $50 a barrel easily. Because then it's not Saudi Arabia. The best oil analysts say they don't have extra spare capacity. Like, if Iranian oil is out of the market for these buyers in Europe or some countries in Asia, Saudi Arabia, they cannot make it up. But Iraq in 3, 4, 5 years could. And this would change the whole equation once again.
Yeah, well, and as Tom says in the introduction to your article, that was part of the neocon plan, only they thought they would own Iraq for the long term. So really,
exactly.
They were actually accomplishing what they wanted, which only it's Iran that turns out to be the ones with the ability to destroy OPEC, which is basically the Saudi kingdom's dictatorship over the price of oil in the world.
Exactly. For the Saudis, they in fact, even if they had the extra capacity, they wouldn't want to use it because they want high oil prices for their internal needs. They have to bribe their whole population, basically. So, you know, but Iran is different. Iran, if they had investments from the Europeans, which is this is something that any independent European advisor or consultant or some diplomats that have a little bit of perspective in their lives. Now, they always say, off the record, of course, look, we're dying to do business with Iran. We cannot do it because of the U.S. sanctions. We need especially their gas. We could go there and say, look, how much money do you need to improve your infrastructure? Because this is the basic problem for Iran. They cannot produce more because they don't have the money to invest in infrastructure or the newest machinery. The Europeans have it, the Canadians have it, the Americans have it. Because of the sanctions, it doesn't go to Iran. Sooner or later, the Chinese are going to Iran and say, look, we improve your infrastructure, but you have to sell all this extra oil and gas to us, which is something that I think it could happen within the next few years easily as well. So in terms of Iran, China, anything the U.S. does is counterproductive because they have, for China, Iran is a matter of national security. They import 22% of their oil from Iran. Soon it could be 30%. Can you imagine, from the point of view of the leadership in Beijing, that's it. You know, this is untouchable. It's even more important for them, in a sense, than Central Asia. Central Asia, they already secured a gas pipeline from Turkmenistan, so they're covered on this angle. And with Russia, there are two pipelines on the way, one for oil, one for gas from Siberia. So they're covered as well. But Iran, for them, is essential. Soon it's going to be 30% of the oil they need, you know. So whatever the U.S. does, forget it, you know.
All right. So tell me the state of the whatever it is in Syria right now. Who's doing what? Who even knows what's going on inside Syria right now?
Exactly. We've, and, you know, these past few days, I didn't even look at what was going on in Syria. I just glanced at a few headlines and, you know, some Middle Eastern papers. Basically, still the same. You know, the stalemate could last another year easily. Because, you know, the repression is going to continue and really, really hardcore. And this is from the lion's mouth. He said that 3 or 4 days ago. And he considers the whole protest movement as a terrorist operation. They, you know, the Assad regime and the intelligence apparatus, they cannot see that they are legitimate grievances, that people, even, you know, stable middle-class people in the big cities in Syria, they are fed up with corruption, especially, and an inefficient economy. And they would like a little bit of more, a little bit of political participation. It doesn't have to be a full-blown Western parliamentary democracy. But, you know, for the regime is thinking, you know, the mentality reminds me of the Soviet Union. By the way, it is based on the Soviet Union. When you travel to some parts of Syria, it looks like you are in Brezhnev, Soviet Union. It's the same impression.
Good times. So, I can't imagine why anybody would be protesting. But now I got to tell you, though, as soon as somebody says the word CIA, I assume that even if somebody means well and is doing something, if the CIA agrees with them, then they're basically a dupe, whether they want to be useful or not, right? How's that work?
Exactly. Exactly, and that's the problem, that's the legitimacy problem of this Syrian National Council and the Free Syrian Army. The Free Syrian Army is the joke. It's a bunch of mercenaries and opportunist defectors a la Libya. It's exactly the same scenario with not, with that base that they that NATO established, in fact, in southern Turkey near the Turkish-Syria border, and you know, this Qatar is smuggling weapons and, you know, operatives to them as well, even via Lebanon. You can even read about that in the Lebanese press, which most of it, by the way, is pro-Sunni, you know. But they publish this stuff. It's easy to find stuff like this as well. So the stalemate will continue. And the problem is, it's not going anywhere. It's not going anywhere. Because I don't see the Free Syrian Army, for instance, liberating parts of Syria, like, you know, Homs, Hama, a big city, the suburbs of Aleppo, for instance. It's impossible. They don't have the numbers. They don't have the organization. The problem is something that we discussed before, probably in the last time we spoke, the possibility of NATO inflicting some sort of mini civil war in northern Syria. This is still part of the... It's a very strong possibility still. But at the moment, the attention span of NATO is now concentrated on Iran. Since the beginning of the year, in fact, they forgot a little bit about Syria because the build-up in Iran was terrifying. In fact, a few days ago was terrifying, actually.
But how popular is the uprising there? I mean, I don't think anybody says that Assad isn't... a dictator or whatever, and that people wouldn't want to overthrow him. But when you look at it, can you give us some kind of ballpark numbers of people or percentages of the population of these towns?
You're right. There are different assessments.
Because there's the Free Syrian Army. That's, you know, I don't know what, the MI6 front group in Turkey or whatever. But
exactly,
I mean, as far as the actual Syrian people.
Exactly. Actual Syrian people. At least one third of the population is still pro-regime because they, with all the drawbacks, at least it's a stable regime. We don't know what could come next, and we don't want an Islamist, Muslim Brotherhood dominated regime. At least half of the population, for a number of reasons, is against the regime. They would like, I would say, one third is radical. They want regime change. And the other half of this, half of the total population, they want at least more political participation, and especially end of corruption, and especially corruption for the three major clans that are part of the leadership, allied with the Assad clan as well. This means they want Christians and Sunnis to have more participation as well in everything in Syria, concentrated with the Alawites. And that's, came with the Hafez Assad Alawization of Syria for the past 40 years. Mm. So it's like North Korea. If you're not part of the Kim Il-sung, Kim Jong-il family, nothing happens to you.
Right. All right, well, we're all out of time. We got to leave it there, but I want to thank you very much for your time, Pepe, as always.
We just scratched the surface, Scott, once again.
Yeah, well, we'll get back to it, I promise.
Okay, man.
Thanks very much.
All right.
All right, everybody, that's the great Pepe Escobar from the Asia Times, atimes.com. And he's got one at tomdispatch.com, sinking the petrodollar in the Persian Gulf. Check it out.